Here we are at the end of season 5, and it's time once again to go home. This season, we've told you weird stories from Japan, England, Spain, and Greenland, just to name a few. But since there's never a shortage of tales from Newfoundland and Labrador, and because we love our home so much, we always clue up the season here. Enough of this intro, let's get it on the go. Welcome to the Somewhere Podcast, a podcast about strange and unusual stories told by us, a sister and brother team hailing from the island of Newfoundland. I'm your co-host, Chrissy.
And I'm your co-host, Barry. There's two traditions we do here at the Somewhere Podcast. Number one, at the end of every season, we do an episode about Newfoundland. And number two, we bring on a special guest. You all know him well. He's your best friend of mine, Trivia Ted.
Bum, ba, ba, ba. That's right. It's me, Trivia Ted.
First off, I want to give a special shout out to Ted because, as you've known in the last 5 seasons, we've been desperately trying to get a listener from Greenland. We've been unsuccessful thus far. We have had a lot of countries I never would have thought of, but Greenland has not been one of them. Our good friend Ted actually went onto a Greenland message board and tried to get someone to listen.
Every time we get a new country, I get very excited, but so far it's never been Greenland. And I'm kind of starting to think that Greenland's not real.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever heard of that conspiracy theory on the interwebs that Australia's not real?
I have not.
Apparently, this is a thing. People will believe anything. So I think I need to start the Greenland isn't real, because why aren't they not listening to the Somewhere Podcast? It's mind-blowing.
They all liked my message. A bunch of people from Greenland, supposedly.
They were all bots.
They're like, I like this. Next you know, you're getting ads for different things. But no, we do appreciate the effort, even though it's been unsuccessful. I mean, we were number 6 in, like, what country was that?
South Korea. I think that's
like,
what it was.
Like a top 10. It's kind of hard to define what this podcast is and what category, but I guess history is what we end up with. And we were number 6 in South Korea for history for a week.
Maybe we're niche.
You guys could maybe have BTS on your podcast.
Who's that?
K-pop.
The boy band.
Yeah. They all had to go in the army or something.
Yeah.
So again, this is our Newfoundland episode, and you know, you figure after a whole season dedicated to Newfoundland, plus we reference it every show, you figure we'd be out of stories, but it seems like one place is rich in folklore and stories is Newfoundland, so I don't think we'll ever exhaust every story, so we can always squeeze a few things out. And this time we actually did a poll. Chrissy, remind everybody what the options were in the poll.
So the options were tables, pirates, statues, or whatever the hell we want.
I'm not sure what one, but we're doing whatever the hell we want, and it's basically all 3 of the things in the poll, so.
I think tables won.
Tables won, there you go.
Because I think people were just wondering what the hell we're going to tell about tables, but we decided it wasn't a majority rule. It was whatever the people want, so we're covering all 4 things.
Yeah, we got votes in all of them, so I said, let's do it all.
Just wondering, is this the adult tour where we can say whatever the hell we want?
It is the adult tour. You can say good. Whatever you want.
Okay, great. Just
jizz.
Anyway, let's get this on the go before we run out of tape.
That's right.
Okay, we're going to let our guest go first in today's episode, and we have no idea what he's going to talk about, so go ahead, Ted.
Me first. Okay, so I said about statues, so that's what I'm going to talk about. There's many different statues in Newfoundland, and also, especially in the States, like there was a lot of controversy in the past number of years. There's always been controversy, but it's been building up. It kind of came to a head in the last number of years about certain statues and why they're there.
What they actually represent or what they did.
Yeah.
And you know, looking back on history, they probably weren't the great person that we thought that they were.
Right.
Yeah. Like they'll erect it under the guise that they're honoring their past. But then when you step back from it and you look at it, it's like, well, it's possibly more of a warning to others. Like,
yes.
Of stay in your place. And it's like the conquerors versus the oppressed and stuff like that. So there's a lot of weird reasons. Now, we have some cool statues here. One being Terry Fox, the great Canadian who tried to run across Canada to raise funds for cancer research in the very early 80s. He made it to Thunder Bay before he got sick and the cancer reoccurred and he passed away. However, we still every year in September do a Terry Fox run. Mm-hmm. So have you ever been down to that statue? It's right down next to the harbor.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I guess that's where the run started. And I guess he put some water, he collected some water from the Atlantic Ocean. His plan was when he got to the Pacific Ocean, he was going to dump it in. or something like that. And I guess that's where he dipped his toe.
He dipped his artificial leg in it.
Are you guys too young to remember Terry Fox?
No, I remember it. It's like one of those first kind of TV memories.
I remember Terry Fox. I mean, he was a very famous historical figure, but I don't recall when he was doing his run here in Newfoundland at the time.
I don't recall it like being on the news or anything, but I do recall watching the footage of him running down the rain, drizzle, and fog, the TCH.
Freezing his arse off.
Yeah, so if you're ever in St. John's, Newfoundland, look for it. It's pretty cool.
He's ranked among one of the greatest Canadians, right?
Yeah.
I want to say he was number two.
Yeah, I think Tommy Douglas was number one, the father of universal healthcare in Canada.
I thought it was Tommy Hunter.
Tommy Hunter.
And he had a show.
The country singer before Hockey Night in Canada.
Tommy Hunter. So I have not seen the Terry Fox statue, but that's pretty cool. It commemorates where he started his run.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. So he would be a good guy, but let's talk about one bad biddy. So you have seen this statue. It's outside the Confederation Building. Some people are like, is that a Viking? But it's actually Gaspar Corte-Real.
Are you talking about the statue across from the Confederation Building?
Yeah, yeah.
That's not John Cabot?
John Cabot's there, but he's tucked up. He's right in front of the building.
Oh, okay, okay.
Back during COVID, like in 2020, a lot of stuff just came to light. Like people just got turned on to it, like say Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement and stuff like that. And just actually objectively looking at statues and like why we have them and what they represent instead of like getting into what actual history is into what is perceived history. Again, going back to why someone would create a statue, like that's interesting.
Yeah. Who commissions the statue?
Well, this is the thing.
Okay.
It wasn't Newfoundland who commissioned it. It was erected in 1965, and it celebrates this guy, Gaspar Corte-Real, and it was a supposed connection between the province and Portugal through mutual fishing off the Grand Banks for several hundred years. So it goes back to 1501, but it was only put up in 1965, so modern history. Now, it came to light in 2020 and before. I mean, the history's history, but he was known as a slaver. Like he had picked up a group of indigenous people. He had enslaved these people.
From Newfoundland?
Where he got them, it doesn't really say.
Okay.
Because back then, and like, you don't know if you're in Newfoundland or Nova Scotia or Greenland, I guess.
Right.
So it's had this notoriety about it. But in truth, like Portugal had probably very little to do with Newfoundland, but it was put here by a dictator who was in Portugal to basically state by the statue, like, hey, we're good buddies. We're friends, right? You and
what?
I, we're friends. Because Canada at the time was pushing back against Portugal and their dictatorship, saying, you're in Africa fighting these wars, just destroying cultures. And they had these colonies. So the right-wing regime, it was called Estado Novo, to clear up their image with the West, this group over there said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to promote a history of the Corte-Real brothers, and Gaspar and Miguel were these explorers. They inserted them as founding figures into the colonization of North America, thus making Portugal a more legitimate player in the Canadian-American identity, which I'm calling old-school fake news.
Yes.
Yes, I was going to say, yeah.
And how come Miguel doesn't have a statue?
I don't know. Sorry, Miguel.
The lesser brother.
Portugal then had a competition to get into North America and to show some influence over another authoritarian regime, Spain, and that was ruled by Francisco Franco.
Francisco Franco. It was like, yeah. Frank Frank, isn't that basically what his name is?
So Spain and Portugal were at this sort of heritage race to extract the most political gain. And there was a number of European nations who were claiming historic rights to continue to fish with Canada's expanding territorial waters. So basically everybody's coming up to Newfoundland, newly joined Canada. They knew the Grand Banks were booming. So they're like, oh, we're your friend. We're your friend. Hey.
Yeah. Give us some of your fish.
Yeah. So this Corte-Real guys, so they believe that it was done just for political leverage. Because the thing is with a statue, when you get it, what are you going to do with a statue? Like, you go, oh, well, you can't take it down now.
Right.
You got to leave it there. It's like eating all your supper. It's like, well, you can't throw it out.
Or it's like getting a shitty gift that your great aunt gave you, but you can't throw it away because you can't make her feel bad.
Absolutely. And it was a bit like, I guess, narcissistic, just to show like, oh, look at this rich culture we have. We're so influential, you know. So with this, basically this history, they believe probably was negligible of any influence. And a lot of it likely never happened. So it was kind of celebrating nothing. If you'll come with me, we can jump across the road to John Cabot. So there is a John Cabot statue, much smaller than the Court Royal statue. So there's two statues of the exact same casting. There's one out in front of Confederation Building in St. John's, and there's also one at Cape Bonavista. He didn't necessarily land there 500 years ago in 1497. This group got together and figured, ah, he landed somewhere. Might as well be Cape Bonavista. And they just decided. They're like, he landed here. And then a young Ted and his family visited it when I was probably 10 years old. In 1997, do you remember the blowout of the 500-year anniversary of Cabot?
Oh, God, yes.
The Matthew came over. Like, they built this actual replica, this big wooden ship.
Everyone wore three-point hats.
There was a special license plate.
There was Cabot beer.
Yes.
It was a blowout. It was a big party. And looking at it through a 2023 lens, I don't think that would ever happen today. There were people living here for millennia, and you came over. It's like, look at all this space.
Yeah.
I mean, it's complicated. History is complicated.
That history, a wise man once said, and that wise man was our history teacher, history is written by the victor. Oh, he probably didn't say, I'm sure that's a common thing, but history is written by the victors, right? So.
Oh, absolutely.
You talk about war and the greatness of war, and you know, because the history books are written by the people that won the war, right? So,
yeah.
A couple other quick statues I wouldn't mind talking about. There's one statue that you didn't bring up, and Chris, you probably don't know this statue is here now because it only got erected, I'd say, in the last 10 years. It's a statue on George Street of a famous musician. Chrissy, who do you think that would be?
Do I take a stab at who it is? Is it Ron Hynes?
It is Ron Hynes.
Good. He deserves a statue.
And for anyone who doesn't know who Ron Hynes is, he's a Newfoundland singer. The Man of a Thousand Songs was his nickname. He had a lot of big hits. He was in the Wonderful Grand Band, which was a TV show slash band, I guess. I'm not really too sure how it was, but...
It was the precursor to Kaiko.
Was he the lead singer? He was in the band, the Wonderful Grand Band.
I guess you could call him the lead singer.
The songs that I know in that band are UIC, which is a song about get your stamps.
I get back into Pogi.
And there's a song, The Babylon Mall, and one was sang by Tommy Sexton, the other one, I can't remember the guy's name, but it wasn't Ron Hynes.
But like with that band, like I guess any Newfoundland band, it's not a classical band. It's like everybody can sing because everybody's talented and everybody can play everything.
They're like the Monkees, not really, but kind of.
The Wonderful Grand Band was more of like musical entertainment group, like Flight of the Conchords kind of a deal. And they did sketches as well. But Ron Hynes was the straight man singer. And he was also a solo artist, like an incredibly talented solo artist.
Yeah. A lot of things like the St. John's Waltz, 30 for 60 is another one he does. There's just too many to name, but he was
Sonny's Dream.
Sonny's Dream, yeah. It's probably his most famous work.
I believe that was recorded by Tommy Makem, was it not?
Yes. Supposedly in Ireland, the Irish claim Sonny's Dream as their own.
Well, I'm not mad at them because a lot of Irish songs I thought were Newfoundland songs.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
But anyway, at some point in the last 8 or 9 years, he did a statue to Ron Hynes at George Street, which is a street famous for all the boroughs, and that's where a lot of musicians made a living for many years here, was playing on George Street on Friday and Saturday nights.
That's one I'm going to talk about, another one, if that's okay. It got me to thinking, in Newfoundland, during especially the First World War, a lot of young Newfoundlanders went away to war. We were a British colony at the time. In 1914, and it was said that no community was left untouched. Now, where I'm from is not a major community, but there was at least 3 war memorials around my small hometown. Even our July 1st, it's Canada Day, but it's also a somber Memorial Day for us. So the last one I'm going to talk about in this section of various statues throughout Newfoundland, this one's called the 100 Portraits of the Great War. And I was actually at this unveiling, brag. What they did was take 100 of relatives of people who fought in the First World War, in the Great War, and they cast their faces in bronze. So it's all the relatives of those people. So instead of initially the dead, it's actually the people who are still living.
Flipping the script on the statues. Way to go.
I really like that.
Yeah.
Speaking of statues and art and cool things or whatever, I don't know, because I'm a little bit older than you. Do you remember in the arts building at Munn, they have a great big statue? I can't remember what it's called, but everyone called it the Red Trench because it looked like a giant disformed vagina.
Yes, oh, yeah. I think it was called the Red Trench.
Oh, was it?
No, I remember that. I would look at that every day as I'd walk through the arts building going, huh, university is different than high school.
Yep. And then I don't know if this is true or this was just a joke we said, that there was a statue or a monolith called the Purple Tower. End off the statues with that one, I guess.
I do have another statue story, which happened, the old people say, a few gardens up. I'll keep that guy for later.
Okay.
We'll hear about that in a little bit. But before we get into that, we want to talk a little bit about pirates.
Yeah.
Pirates was on the poll and people did vote for it. For me, the greatest pirate association I have with Newfoundland is a place called the Pirate's Cave.
First image that came into my head.
Yeah.
I used to think it was like an amusement park you could
go
to.
Me too, exactly.
Okay.
But before we get into that, do you know what the Pirate's Cave is?
No, I do not.
Every Sunday, our family used to always go to our grandparents in Carbonear for Sunday dinner or cold plate or whatever. It was a tradition that our family did for years and years, really. Like, and it wasn't just us. It was like our aunts and uncles and all coming to be like 20 kids and everybody in this little house, and they all be playing 120s when we get running around in the garden.
Yes.
And things like that. On the trip in Harbor Grace, there was a place called the Pirate's Cave. And I used to drive by it, and I was thinking, this is the coolest looking place. It was like a rock-shaped building, and it had these two huge pirates painted out in these rocks. So I thought, like I said, it was a amusement park. It was actually a nightclub.
Yep.
And what? Would you ever go there?
Oh, yes. I've been to the cave.
I've never been to the cave. I guess it was before my time.
Well, technically, it was before my time, too, but I went in anyway.
Mom, yep. Sorry. But yeah, so what was it like in there?
There was a bar and like a dance floor and chairs around. It was just like a regular
club, yeah.
There wasn't any cool pirate motif inside. The outside looked fantastic, but the inside was just kind of like any other place.
Yeah. No, it was like this green pirate building. We'll find a picture of it if we can and send it in the old social media feeds.
You'll have to send me a picture of it because I keep picturing something that's like chiseled out of the side of a cliff.
That's kind of what it looked like.
Yeah. But anyway, the first thing I always think of when I think of pirates in Newfoundland is the Pirate's Cave. Basically, it was gone before we got to hit the clubs, and it was before Kirsty stopped, but she managed to get in there beforehand, so that's good. First pirate I'd like to talk about is the great French pirate, Jean-Pierre Lafitte.
Oh.
You remember him?
No.
He was a notorious French pirate who plundered Bret Hart's ring jacket that he used to wear before matches made by his mother.
When am I going to stop falling for it? That's the question.
This culminated in a match in the 1995 In Your House pay-per-view where Bret won and got his jacket back. Ted, you remember Jean-Pierre Lafitte, right?
No, I don't think so. I really want to.
Well, he was one of the Quebecers.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, after the Quebecers split up and went on, he became a pirate. But anyway, yeah, I always loved Jean-Pierre Lafitte, so I figured I'd bring that one up. Yeah, you got to fit the wrestling name when you can. But in reality, the most notorious pirate to ever sail the seas of Newfoundland was a man by the name of Peter Easton. And I'm sure you're both familiar with that name.
Familiar with the name, but not real familiar with the story for some reason.
I know of him. I know the name. And also Peter Easton's pub is a sketchy bar downtown.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. If you're looking to get like stabbed.
Oh, God.
If you get plundered.
Yeah. Peter Easton is like the Bret Hart of pirates. Like he's
pretty much
popular.
Yeah. Yeah, or the Jean-Pierre Lafitte of pirates, you wouldn't want to say. Yeah, but he was born in or around 1570 in England. Not a whole lot known about his early life. I guess history wasn't as documented then as it is now. But in the early 1600s, he was tasked by Queen Elizabeth I to protect Newfoundland fishing vessels during a period of war between England and Spain. He was a very skilled naval officer and privateer, and very successful in defending the Newfoundland fishing fleet. As we know about John Cabot from our heritage moment, the fishery of Newfoundland was very important to the empire for food, and he was given the task of protecting it. His base of operations was Harbour Grace, which, you know, is one of the oldest settlements in Newfoundland, very famous for the Pirate's Cave Bar, which we've just discussed. Unfortunately for Peter Easton, but not for the nations of England and Spain, On June 23rd, 1604, a peace deal was brokered between the warring nations. So that left Peter and all the privateers unemployed, because there's no more wartime, he didn't need to defend the things. He applied for EI, but didn't have the required stamps. So he didn't get his claim, so he said, fuck it. Instead of attacking and plundering Spanish ships on behalf of the British Empire, I'll do it on behalf of making me rich. And that's what he did. And he was very successful in these pirating ways. He would attack Spanish ships in the Atlantic and was also hired by the wealthy Kellagrews family of Cornwall. Now, that's where the area of Kellagrews must be named after, I'm assuming. Right? Yeah. That can't be a coincidence, I don't think.
No. They move there and they're like, huh, who would have thunk it?
Well, this town is named after us. We may as well live here.
Oh, boys. We should hang out here. It's
what a quinky dink. But so they were a wealthy family, and they hired Peter Easton and his motley crew to travel to the Mediterranean to plunder Spanish vessels. He would attack Spanish ships in the Atlantic, and he would also demand protection money from the English vessels in the area. So he was kind of like the original mobster.
Yes.
By the time 1612 rolled around, he had an armada of 10 pirate ships, and were all based at Harbor Grace. At this point, he didn't care what nationality the people were. He just attacked whoever had money. At his height, he had 1,500 pirates under his command. Over those years, one of the many people he captured was a high-ranking British naval officer, and he was allowed to leave in order to travel to England and obtain a pardon for Easton's pirating crimes. And he actually received his pardon.
Okay.
And once receiving the pardon, he decided to retire and live the rest of his life off his plunder. He bought a mansion, got married, and lived out his days in some place known as Villefranche Savoy, which is pronounced incorrectly, but it's a French area. And there's actually a pirate graveyard in Harbor Grace filled with many of Peter's men. Did you know this?
I did not know that. Actually, I didn't know that Peter Easton even was connected to Harbor Grace, but I guess that's probably why they had the Pirate's Cave bar there. Harbor Grace is a fascinating place. They have a fairy ring and a pirate graveyard.
Yeah, this must be the place to be.
Yeah.
I don't know where it is. I just read that and I said that's something I need to find and visit at some point, but I don't know exactly where it is. I think it's right behind where the Pirate's Cave bar was.
Maybe the Pirate's Cave was built on the old pirate graveyard.
But for Peter, had many adventures and many stories and all that kind of stuff, but there's one very interesting one about some hidden treasure from one of his plunders. It's on Shelbird Island. Shelbird Island is a small river island on the Bay of Islands from Lark Harbor past the city of Cornerbrook. So it's over on the west coast of Newfoundland. It's overlooked by a 40-foot tall cliff. And in the cliff, the way the rocks are shaped, it resembles an old bearded sailor, commonly referred to as the old man in the mountain. Very similar to the goat's ass in North River.
The goat's hole?
Do you ever hear the goat's hole before, Ted?
No, I have not.
If you ever driving across the Veterans Highway there?
Yeah.
Okay, well, when you're driving on the Veterans Highway, and for anybody who doesn't know, there's a highway that connects the Trans-Canada Highway, which you get to St. John's, to the Bay Area where Chrissy and I are from. It's called the Veterans Memorial Highway, which is named after veterans of the war, which we just kind of discussed there in Ted's story. We call it the Giver Road because instead of driving through the towns, you can only drive 50, 60, you can drive 100 on this because it's a highway.
So you give her.
You give it to her.
Give her.
But anyway, when you go to North River, there's one spot in the cliff that's there. There's like a rock shape and it looks like a goat's hole. Or goat's ass. That's what he's called, the goat's hole.
Yep.
But anyway. The Corner Brook version of that is by Shelbert Island. It was called The Old Man and the...
maybe the old man's face is a Corner Brook and his arsehole is in North River.
There you go. What could be it.
His feet are the Azores.
That's right. But legend has it that there's treasure buried on this Shelbert Island. There's several origin stories to this treasure, but the most popular one is the plunder is from the notorious Peter Easton. The story goes that Easton's group of pirates plundered a French merchant ship off the west coast of Newfoundland. And during this plunder, they were spotted by a massive French warship. Despite Peter being a very great naval tactician, he knew he was no match for this vessel. So he did exactly what you do when you're outmatched. You run. He fled up the coast of Newfoundland and was chased by French marines. And on his boat, he had three chests on board full of gold and necklaces and all this weird shit the pirates have for some reason. Gold crosses and crowns. I don't understand why they got all this shit. I don't know.
Rubies and stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
Scepters,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. So Easton hated the idea of this warship catching up to him and taking all this fortune that he so rightfully stole. So he did what all pirates do. He went to bury it. Now, I never understood the concept of burying treasure, but I guess in this it kind of makes sense. You know, you're running away, someone's going to catch you, you got to hide it so that they can't get it. And then, you know, when you're not in that situation, you can go back up and dig it up and get your money back, right?
I think that's more lore.
I do too.
Yeah, that you leave stuff.
Well, in this situation, like I said, you hide it so that if they do catch it, they don't get it, right? So that kind
of
makes
sense.
A
really labor-intensive way of hiding your stuff. Like, just throw a blanket over it or something.
Yeah, throw it in the woods.
Throw it in the woods.
Or just wear it all.
Yeah, that's right. That's my bling. I have 12 scepters and 12 crowns. This is how I roll.
It's like when you're going through security at an airport and your luggage is overweight and you have to put on a sweater and a hoodie and a couple of pairs of jeans.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, Peter didn't want to bury himself. So he looked at his first mate and said, take those heavy ass chests and bury them somewhere and we'll get them on the way back. So the first mate grabbed another pirate and he got in his rowboat and he loaded up the three chests and he started rowing up the river. They spotted the old man in the mountain and said, this is a good marker so that, you know, when we got to come find this, we'll know where to go. We'll look at this face and, you know, it's kind of pointing right down to this Shellbird Island. So they get on the island, they dig three holes to bury the treasure. So apparently, and unbeknownst to the other pirate who was with the first mate, it's customary to bury a fresh corpse along with the loot to have the spirit of the dead man protect the loot until the pirates return so nobody else can steal it, right? So that brings up two things. Number one, the first mate waited till the holes were dug and promptly killed the other pirate, which I dubbed the Red Shirt Pirate.
Yep.
Yes.
We're going to take Captain Kirk, we're going to take McCoy, and Ensign Smith. Who's going to survive? So that type of thing, right? Number one, this Red Shirt guy must have been a pretty new pirate, unaware of this custom. Otherwise, why the hell would he go?
Right.
And number two, wouldn't the ghost be a little aggressive towards the pirates who killed him when they returned to get their riches?
Like, oh, yeah.
I'm killing you now. You protect it till I come back and get it. No, I think I'll haunt you instead.
Oh, geez, what do you have, boys? Yes, come on. Yeah, the treasure's fine. Have a cup of ghost tea.
I scared away a few people for you. But either way, the first mate kills this dude, and he goes back to go to Easton Ship. So he gets in the rowboat, starts rowing up, and unfortunately, there was some strong current, and the boat capsized, and the guy drowned before making it back. The secret of where this treasure was buried went down with him. So, according to the legend, two of the three chests have been located, one in the late 1880s and another in 1934. However, one still exists. It's still out there for any treasure hunter should they dare to try and find it and deal with the ghost that guards it, who's obviously a shitty guard because two of the chests are already gone.
Well, maybe he was spiteful, like you said. He could have protected.
Yeah, I'll let you take it because you're not the pirates who come back for it. They're the ones I'm getting. But yeah, you hear these stories all the time about buried treasure. I know Oak Island is a TV show that comes on a History Channel where there's been 8 seasons trying to dig up shit and never found anything, right? So,
you said they found two of them. Who found them and where are they?
Never really said in the story. It said, you know, treasure hunters found them, one in the 1880s and one in 1934. NPCs found them.
Long enough away so you're not really questioning what happened to them since.
Exactly, right? You know, you always like a good pirate story and you can't have a pirate story without buried treasures.
Yeah.
That's the tale of Peter Easton, the great pirate of Harbor Grace.
So do you think there's going to be a Oak Island-esque show about looking for Peter Easton's treasure in Corner
I think based on the publicity they're going to get from this podcast, I can't see any other outcome.
Three people are going to go looking.
Yeah. It's a given.
Shall we get to the last of the stories here now?
Give her.
All right, here we go. Give her like we're on the Veterans Highway. I'm going to tell you some stories about tables. In terms of the Barry and Ted trivia, this story is a stretch.
Nice.
It's about tables, but it's more like table adjacent. A lot of living takes place around a table. Much ado is made about your Thanksgiving or Christmas tablescapes, complete with folk art like handprint turkeys or poop logs. Please see season 5, episode 5, if you have no idea what a poop log is. The youngest children in a family are often given the task of setting the table as their first responsibility. It's where we gather to eat, tell stories, have a game of 120s or Romoli. Tables are almost like the altars for folklore, if you think about it. It's the place for the cornerstones of cultural heritage: food, stories, lessons, and communal gathering. Tables can even be your livelihood if you rent them out to use for Comic Cons and Horror Cons. But please know how to treat the crypt keeper if you want to get into this highly stressful line of work. Fortunately, I don't think that Tim Robinson is a listener, so I won't have to shoulder the burden of causing his mental breakdown over the discussion of tables. But if he is a listener, he should definitely message us. And even though Tim's character in the Driver's Ed sketch of the fantastic sketch comedy show, I Think You Should Leave, quote, can't know how to hear any more about tables, I hope that you'll settle in to hear some table-adjacent weird stories from Newfoundland.
Love it.
Oh, yeah. that whole intro is just for us because
yeah, that's right. That's
but anyway,
inside baseball, I think is the term. Yeah.
Okay, so my section of the podcast is all about stories that happened in and around Mun. We all went to Memorial University of Newfoundland, hereafter to be referred to as Mun, and we all lived in residence houses in Peyton College. Is it Peyton College or Patton College? Peyton College, right?
Peyton.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
One T.
You get a laundry bag with it written on it.
What?
That's when you first go to residence. That's to do it. They give you a laundry bag with Peyton College written on it.
Oh, when I went to residence, they gave you SFA. Sweet fuck all. Anyway, so we all lived in residence houses. And anyone who's ever lived in a university residence or a dorm or went to a sleepover camp or has even been part of a group of young people can probably recall some sort of ghost story or legend passed down from year to year. These always seem to happen when you're 22 or younger. No one starts their first job and is warned not to park in a particular spot because it's haunted by the ghost of a guy who fell off on the roof of the building. Although, I do recall that in my office way back when I first started, there was a particular chair that nobody would sit in because it seemed that whoever sat in that chair would become pregnant soon after. I don't know what the fuck was going on in that chair prior to the conceptions. Hopefully nothing untoward. But it was more about us laughing about the correlation between two unrelated occurrences.
No black light in that chair.
It was weird, though. But I could easily see this as the progression of an origin story of a lot of folktales. Completely unrelated things, and then it becomes a thing. Anyway, back in 1992, I moved into Curtis House to start my frosh year at Mun. It housed three floors of female students from frosh to fourth years, and within a week or two, the older girls started in with their stories. There are two stories about hauntings of Curtis House. One was the one that I heard in my own personal experience, and another that I read about in an article in the oft-mentioned and always fabulous Memorial University of Newfoundland Folklore and Language Archives, The Munfla. I don't know if they call it Munfla or if they call it Mun FLA or what. I call it Munfla. So from the Munfla, I found a story in the volume 26, 2004 edition of a publication called Culture and Tradition that told the story of the ghost of Curtis, and here's the gist. The land on which Curtis House was built was originally a bog. While this seems like a questionable choice from a civil engineering standpoint, there it is. I guess Curtis must be one of the younger houses because, according to the lore, a boy got a girl pregnant from a different residence house and told her to get rid of the baby or he'd break up with her. The article actually says that a girl got pregnant, but not since the Immaculate Conception of Jesus, or possibly the magic chair in an office in Central Jersey, has a girl simply became pregnant without the express contribution of a boy. Details like the name of the people, the other residents, or even the year that this happened remains vague. But for some reason, she felt that he was quite the catch because after she gave birth, she did murder the baby and put the poor little body in the bog, which was to be the future site of Curtis House.
God. Sorry, I'm just like, that's legit.
I know. Don't worry, I don't think it's a true story. Later, the people in Curtis House would swear that they would see the ghostly image of a little girl all in white who could be heard saying in a creepy, ethereal voice, "Mommy, please don't leave me," or something similar. Why a baby who only lived a very short time then manifests as a child ghost old enough to speak is a Nunya point in this story. Nunya meaning Nunya business, or in other words, it doesn't make sense, but if you willingly suspend your disbelief, you'll enjoy the story a lot more.
I thought this baby English, like the ducks hanging out in the bog.
It was like Friday the 13th. Jason Voorhees was a boy who drowned, and next thing you know, he's a man with a hockey mask, right?
That's true. Yeah, mm-hmm. I never thought about that. Yeah. Here I could talk about the misogynistic undertones and slut-shaming baked into this ghost story pie, but this is a story about tables, not a gender studies paper. The second version of the ghost story of Curtis is one that was part of my experience and has less infanticide, but still achieves its goal of asking your roommate to go with you to the bathroom in the middle of the night, lest you have a paranormal experience. In the story that I was told, back in the 1960s when Curtis House was built, and I have no idea when it was actually built, one night, a little girl was playing on the construction site. Tragically, she fell into the wet concrete foundation, and the workers didn't know she was there. She died, and her ghost has haunted Curtis House ever since. She can be seen glowing all in white, especially at night in the bathrooms, where she would magically appear when you were at the sinks, and you can catch a glimpse of her behind you in the mirror. Horror trope, anyone?
Yeah,
jeez.
I guess you guys didn't have stories like this in the boys' house, did you?
No, I don't recall any ghost stories. It was very scary taking a shit, but not because not because of any ghosts. It's because the chance you can actually do it in peace.
Why was it so scary to take a shit in Burns' house?
Because you get bagged, which is basically someone would fill up a bag of water, and while you're trying to take a shit, they just throw it in over the stall, and you get soaked.
Who had to clean that up?
The janitor, I guess, or the frosh.
And, like, they'd hope to hit the toilet paper as well.
Oh, God.
I never did get bagged, but you just, like, stop and be so silent. You'd really, like, zone in on their movements. It's like in me and Barry's favorite game, Last of Us, where you can hit a button where you have super hearing.
That's right.
And you'd be, like, listening and go, do you hear any, like, plastic in their hands? Or are they laughing? Or are they just coming in to do their business?
Right.
After about the second time it happened to me, I would either go to the chemistry building or, if I couldn't make it on time, the pit down in the first floor. Which is... So the first floor was basically the president's room, and there was like two other rooms, and that was it. So there's a little bit more peace there versus, you know, the third floor.
Objectively speaking, would you rather go to the bathroom and have a ghost girl behind you or get bagged?
That's a tough one.
You're not getting wet, I suppose.
That's right. Unless you piss yourself because you're so scared.
Well, you're already over the toilet, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah. There you go. This is convenient.
Anyway, sorry. Continue.
Anyways, so, I mean, it was kind of a popular thing in the girls' house anyway to A, lock the doors, and B, have ghost stories. The ghost girl in the bathroom also caused many of us to make sure that there was someone with us in the bathroom at night. And another thing that this ghost girl would do for some random reason was scatter your powdered laundry detergent around your room. That was very common to see detergent on your floor if you happened to leave your door unlocked. And surely this was the ghost and not someone playing a prank. Let's be clear on that.
Oh, yeah.
One question that you might have on this story, the story that I was told about the girl falling into the concrete, is if the workers weren't aware that she was in the concrete, how do we know her whole origin story?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a simple answer. Tables.
Ooh.
This is a stretch, let me tell you. I'm really exercising my creativity here.
I see how you fit it in here, yeah.
Okay. Back in the 1800s in upstate New York, a New Age quasi-religious movement started, which we now know as spiritualism. In a nutshell, people started losing their shit when a couple of young girls, the Fox Sisters, discovered that they could reach beyond the veil and communicate with the spirits via a series of knocks and raps. Using some kind of Morse code-like system, eventually they went from answers like yes and no to detailed conversations. But you can imagine that this was hella tedious. Industrious people improved upon this communication much in the same way as we went from the telegraph to the telephone to the mobile phone to the smartphone. One of these earlier innovations was table tipping. This was some way where a crowd of spiritualists would gather around a table and communicate with the other side by interpreting what was being said based on how the table was moving about. I guess you would need a designated table and a fair-sized room to be friggin' around with that one, so an entrepreneurial spiritualist invented an easy-to-use, small table with a smaller table on top and called it the Ouija board. So, you know, a Ouija board has a planchette, mm-hmm. the pointer.
Yep.
Planchette is somehow derived from French for tables. And it was a way to, instead of using a giant table that you're eating your dinner on, shrink it down to a small table with another smaller table on top. This was small and portable and mass-produced by a toy company, and it was a huge hit. Up until the release of the Based on a True Story book and subsequent movie The Exorcist, no one thought that a Ouija board was a harbinger of evil. For further information on just how much of that story is true, please see Season 3, Episode 7. So before The Exorcist, people thought of the Ouija board as just a useful tool for communicating with the dead. But this story takes place decidedly after The Exorcist, so the Ouija board was seen as a portal to hell if you didn't know how to use it correctly. Now, one thing that inevitably happens when you get a group of 18 to 22-year-olds living together in a possibly haunted dorm is someone is going to break out a Ouija board. Another almost universal truth is that university students are notoriously short on funds and tall in ingenuity. This was true for the ladies of Curtis House, so when it came time to getting hold of a small table with the alphabet, numbers, and yes and no printed on it so that they could talk to the spirit of a little girl, they used what they had, the bottom of their desk drawers.
Nice.
Have you ever heard this story?
No.
No.
Oh, okay. I was told that years before I moved into the house, residents would take their desk drawers out, flip them over, fashion a homemade Ouija board by writing just like you would on a Ouija board, and then using a shot glass as a planchette. Voila, homemade Ouija board at no cost to you.
There you go.
And we were told that just a few years before my frosh year, one resident discovered one of these homemade boards, disassembled her entire desk, dragged it out into the square, and burned it. And I feel like this would have made the news or something, especially because it was only a few years before me. But somehow I believed it. And you could be sure that I checked under my desk drawer for a board. Fortunately, there was not one there.
And I was just laughing earlier because residence furniture is pretty much indestructible.
Oh, it's bolted into the cinder block.
It's again, it's like prison. You're just taking what you can use.
Yeah. So that was my sort of table-related story.
I think you worked in them well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I got one more shorter table story. Again, it's centered around Mon.
The alma mater.
Our alma mater, if you were. Or the university, apparently none of us had a choice to go to or not.
It's been established.
Yes. I know you weren't familiar with the ghost of Curtis, and how would you be? But I think you're probably going to know a little bit more about this one. So another bit of table-related Mun lore is around a building with tons of study tables, i.e. the QE2 library. Now, everyone has heard the rumor, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that number one, the library was built backwards, and number two, the library is sinking.
Yeah, I've heard both of those.
Yes.
Yes. Both of these are not true. In fact, the same or similar rumors are told about university libraries across everywhere. If you just Google sinking library, you'll see tons of stories from all over, including an entry in the granddaddy of debunking sites, Snopes.com. It's not true.
Is that right?
Yeah. But there's another supposedly true story that you may or may not know about, which is why the study rooms at the QE2 don't have privacy. You see, Ted, Barry, and dear listeners from Greenland, there used to be curtains so that you could study in peace and quiet, but they all had to be removed after a security guard found a couple canoodling right there on the table in the study room, just like it was their own personal cheap motel room.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true because it was me. No.
Stud.
That's right.
I personally heard that story as an absolute truth when I was at Mun, but I was never really convinced it was true. Did you guys ever hear that story?
I didn't hear about the curtains, but okay. I did hear that. That was a super common rumor.
Yes.
Like I was hanging out in the library a lot and you're like, oh yeah, somebody was caught doing it.
Yeah.
In the study rooms.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
The version of the story that I heard even had the girl of the couple being expelled from Mun and the boy was just told not to do it again.
I don't mean to laugh. Unfortunately, that's probably what would have happened. You know what I mean? That's the way society...
He's a good boy.
Oh, yeah. That's boys right. will be boys and girls will be sluts. So I'm just going to leave that there because I'm really fucking tired about this double standard. Even if it is a fake story, I'm still tired of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
100%.
Yeah. So was this just another story to control the student body's urges to drag off to the study room? And the, I'm guessing, very uncomfortable tables within? Probably and likely. But like all good urban legends, this story does seem to be kind of believable, and it serves its purpose of being a cautionary tale. Don't have sex in a library table, or else you'll be kicked out of school.
I mean, I'll go as far as to say it's probable that a couple at some point in the history of Mon hooked up into a library.
I guess.
But I don't know.
Just a legend, supposedly. Like, because if you're a security guard, are you really going to stand there, wait until people get dressed and go, come on down. Wouldn't you just say to the security guard, like, get out of here, you perv? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
So there's no evidence of this.
All I know is that I was told that it was true. That I was never told who it was, when it happened, you know, any of that stuff. It's just that it did happen.
They never sent the CSIs in to do the whole investigation.
No.
No. Just had the lone security guy. No black lights involved. But you guys have both heard that story as well, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. But anyway, those are how I could try to knit in some kind of table-related story in honor of Tim Robinson and our Twitter poll. Ted, are you going to tell your up-the-garden story or what?
Yeah.
All right, let's get to it.
So we'll get back to talking about statues. Now, we've talked about big statues and well-known in Newfoundland statues, but this is a very much smaller statue that you could even fit in your pocket. And it was fit in a pocket at one time. So this was recorded by actually my mother, who she was the main editor in a Come Home yearbook several years ago. So this one's called The Soldier and the Statue. I'm going to pretty much read it out verbatim.
Do you have permission from the author?
Yes, I do.
Okay, excellent.
From my mother. I did ask her. I said, Mom, I'm going to be on a podcast. Can I read out, sir? Oh, yes, she said.
Yes, so my darling, and everything that you do is perfectly wonderful. I'm sure she's like every other Newfoundland mother, and that was just my impression of my own mother.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, no, she was very supportive. She said, yes, you can go right ahead. So this involves local people out home. So Mr. Jim O'Brien of Southeast and his wife Mary, they had four sons enlist in World War I, one in the Navy and three in the Army. Mike, who was in the Navy, survived the war. And of the three other involved in combat, only Lawrence returned home safely. So that means two of the boys died. He later moved to the United States. The war claimed Albert, who died at 25 years old on July 29, 1917, and Patrick, who was killed on September 2, 1918, at the age of 21. Their mother attributed Lawrence's safe return to a statue that she had given him to carry. This statue is like a little Virgin Mary that you will put in a little tiny, like, aluminum canister, and you could put it in and turn it around. It actually had a screw top, so you could put it in and actually take out the statue. More than two decades later, in 1940, so Second World War, when Thomas Lennon, who lived up the road, enlisted in the Gunners of Newfoundland Heavy Artillery, Mrs. O'Brien gave him the statue to carry with him for protection. While in England, waiting for orders, Thomas Lennon showed his statue to another soldier who seemed taken with it. When they received their orders, Thomas was sent to France and the other man was sent to Africa. The soldier asked Thomas for the statue, but because Mrs. O'Brien had given it to him for protection, he was reluctant to part with it. But he reflected that maybe somehow, if he gave it to him, it might protect them both. So he told the soldier he would give it to him on condition he would return it after the war. And so the soldier promised to give it back to him after the war. Thomas wrote his name and his home address on a piece of paper and put it inside the metal case that held the statue. Thomas Lennon survived the war and came home safely to Southeast. He never heard from the soldier again. A couple of years later, after the war was over, Thomas received a letter with the statue enclosed from a woman in Germany telling him that she found the statue with Thomas Lennon's name and address among her father's things. She told him that her father had been stationed in Africa during the war and that he told her that while his battalion was in the Sahara Desert, the largest desert in the world, he was walking on the sand one day when he eyed the object, quote, glistening in the sun, end quote. He picked it up and found the statue with Thomas Lennon's name and Southeast address inside. The soldier's daughter wrote that she wanted to return the statue to its owner. Thomas never knew what happened to the soldier that he gave the statue to, but thought he must have been killed somewhere in the desert. And although Mrs. O'Brien died before the war was over, her statue seemed destined to come home to Southeast, just like she must have prayed it would after surviving two world wars, crisscrossing three continents, witnessing suffering and death, and protecting first her own son and then her young friend.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Where is the statue right now?
I believe it's still in the family.
That's a pretty cool story.
So after going World War I, World War II, Germany, and back again.
And being found in the friggin' desert like that.
Yeah. Supposedly, like, that was the story. That was what the lady who sent it said her father had said where he found it.
Her father was a Nazi?
Well, this is the thing. With history, you just have to go by sometimes if it's a first-hand account.
Right.
He had said that he found it, quote, glistening in the desert.
Yeah.
And saw something in the sand. So, like, who knows, right?
Yeah. But in the end, at least the daughter saw fit to send it back.
Yeah, amazing that it made its way back to the Southeast.
It could have been stuck in Dieppe forever, never
That's
to
right.
be seen again.
Hey-o. That's Canadian Post Office humor.
That's right.
Anyway, 69% of our listeners are Canadian, so 69% of the people will get that.
Yeah, only me Canadians. I guess people in the East, because from my understanding, Dieppe is like a hub for Atlantic Canada. So
Atlantic Canadians?
Atlantic Canadians, I don't know. But I think it goes there, and then from there it goes to its final destination. So it's not actually in Dieppe all this time. It's just it gets scanned there and doesn't get scanned until it goes to its final destination. So it just seems like it's there all the time.
But we do have listeners in every province and territory in Canada.
Is that
nice?
Cool. But not Greenland. Anyway.
No. I tried.
You did. And we very much appreciate all this unpaid labor.
Yeah, plea to anybody out there. I know nobody from Greenland is listening, but if you know somebody from Greenland, talk to your friend and just say, subscribe to the podcast. Cost nothing.
You just got to listen to 30 seconds before it counts as a listen. Like, that's all I need.
I'm asking for much.
Yeah.
Don't be so friggin' childish.
Not even for a cup of coffee a day.
That's right.
Not even for that. It's just a listen. Don't make such a big deal out of it, people. Come on.
Why are you making it such a thing? Just listen.
What, is there a problem here?
What, are you better than me?
Yeah, we're losing South Korea. We're losing everybody.
You see all the stats dropping.
That's right. Wow.
Unfollow.
Them crowd is some rude. Anyways, was that the end of your statue story?
Yeah, that's the end of the statue story.
Perfect. I like it.
Yeah, that was great. So there you have it. Another season in the books, another episode about Newfoundland. Before we go on, we'd like to thank our special guest, Trivia Ted, for joining us. Ted, do you want to give any plugs or anything?
No, thank you. From me and Linda the dog and Sugar the cat. And I'm what you call in wrestling a mark for this podcast. I really enjoy
there
it.
There you go. You're always welcome, of course. If you do enjoy Ted, he can be heard on the Narrows and Broomheads podcast as well. With me, not as often as Ted. I need to get on there more, but anyway. it's a podcast about Degrassi, but we are doing my so-called life.
We have fun.
Check it out. It's like I said, myself and Ted are both on it with a couple other people from all across this beautiful nation of ours.
That's the end of this season, like Barry said. We are planning on doing season 6, but we're going to take a break so we can get it all prepped up. So stay tuned for that coming probably, I'm going to say, maybe late summer, early fall.
Yeah. It might be a little bit longer break than we normally have. I think our goal is to try and have as much of it in the can, quote unquote, as possible. We don't like having breaks where, you know, we don't have episodes released when we'd like to. So,
but fortunately, we have a pretty good back catalog now, so you just go back and re-listen. It's fine.
That's right.
Okay, and if you have any stories that you want us to talk about in the upcoming season 6, go ahead. You can share those ideas with us at someweirdpodcast@gmail.com.
Or on the Twitter or Instagram machine at somewordpod.
Or our website, somewordpodcast.com.
And if you haven't done so already, please follow, subscribe wherever you listen so you never miss an episode.
And of course, if you've enjoyed this episode and you want to help us out, please leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen so others can discover us. And don't be afraid to tell a friend about the Some Weird Podcast.
Season 5 of the Some Weird Podcast is Some Weird by
Some Weird. 'Man, we got a lot of digressions, but okay. What? Fucking iPad.
What's going
Bam.
On?
Bam.
Mother. After I yelled at you for knocking down your microphone.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Okay, hang on. Let me...
That was karma. That's what that was.
It was. Ted is a witch, obviously. All right.
That's my next story.
Is it really?
Ooh, I know.
What are you, a Scooby-Doo ghost?
Okay. Old Man Withers.
Yeah, and I would have got away with it too if it wasn't for you podcasters.
When you were at Mon, did nobody ever give you, like, fill out this questionnaire for my folklore class? Or did you not know anyone who did folklore?
No, I guess I was more in with the residence gang.
Geology crowd.
The botanist crowd?
Geology crowd. I did a few geology courses, and I did consider doing earth sciences and geology for a very short period of time. But Barry and my other friends still refer to me like as doing geology after 20 plus years of being out of school. So.
What did you actually do? Education, right?
Yeah, well, I did science first.
Okay.
And kind of like I didn't major in it, but you can pick which courses you do within biology. So like I stayed away from animals and hung out with plants. Plants were where it was at.
Modern day Gregor Mendel you are.
Yeah, I'm also a celibate monk.
Fuck. What the heck? All right. I got to get a paper towel. Hang on.
Sorry, Chris.
Mid-mouthful there. Spit it all over.
Yeah, that was a good, that was a spit take. Even though I apologize, that's pretty good, though.
It was a fully natural spit take, like unplanned. And you're lucky that I did spit into my microphone. Very angry at you. Anyway, this is going to be a really long blooper reel, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.